Good evening, James McKenna here with my Science Hour for June 30th, 2022. And my note sheets here for tonight are just packed top to bottom. It's just, if you saw this, you would laugh. There's no way I'm going to get all of this into one program, so it'll carry over into next week. But that's okay, because what I'm arriving at here, you've heard of my history through starting out literally in high school and then through college and then the things that prepared me for, you know, my life up to this point. But there's a literal explosion of involvement of my work in the mid-1990s, and starting actually about 1991. I talked about being gainfully unemployed, but during that time I ended up getting a teaching position, teaching electronics, and then also astronomy and physics at a state university system. So that added 4 years to my resume of teaching. So I fell back onto teaching for an income, basically, and that was fine. I mean, it was good. I almost would like to teach again someday, because I like being in the classroom. And I, like I said, my astronomy class started out, they asked me to teach astronomy. I was teaching physics. And so they asked me, because the guy who had been teaching, the physicist there who was teaching astronomy, I don't remember the situation. He couldn't do it anymore. So they asked me, and I said, sure. And so I ended up with 30 students in my first class, 60 in my second quarter class, because it doubled. Word got out that it was a very interesting class. And then the third semester, no, these are quarters, I'm sorry, quarters, they're on a quarter system at the university level here. But the third quarter, I had 195 students. And I'll just tell a little story. I had a student come up to me and say the following. They said, I took a course at the University of Minnesota, which was the main university in Minneapolis, the Minneapolis campus, that they had taken a astronomy course there, and then they needed another elective, so they were able to take my astronomy course. And the student said, I didn't know astronomy was interesting, because the professor would come in and just write all this stuff on the board and equations and walk out, and it was like, wow, this is astronomy. This is really boring. And so when they took my astronomy class, I brought it to life. And even though I had to teach from a textbook, which brings up the next topic. I mentioned this before. It's the 1991 video you can see of me. It's professionally produced. The school had grants that they would give, and you could develop audiovisual materials. And so I said, okay, I'm going to develop a program here. And the other thing that happened is, because I was teaching astronomy, and by the way, this is 1991, the year that Planet X was literally discovered, but of course that's irrelevant now, because I didn't find that out until about 1995, when all of those pieces started to come together. But anyway, I'm teaching astronomy, university state system. And all of these book salesmen come into my office. All of them had reviewed and renewed their astronomy textbooks for the university level that year. And so there were, I forget, there was like 15 of them. And some companies, some of the textbook publication companies, would publish two or three books, because they were at different levels. One was like for general students, so it was not a lot of mathematics, etc. Then there would be the next level, which would be, say, for science majors or something like that. And then there would be, say, the very advanced astronomy for people that may be astronomy majors or space science or physics, you know, going on to graduate school. So it would be a more detailed astronomy textbook for, this is for college level. And so all in all, there were probably about 15 textbooks. And so I said, yeah, send me a copy. And I did it to all of them. And I thought, man, I got all these textbooks here. And I've got this grant, which is being given to me to produce a video. So they brought in a professional studio producer, editor, and we shot the film. And you can see me, well, Well, how many decades ago is that? You'll see me as a bit younger person. And this video is on my DVD set, DVD number one and two, that's on my webpage. So hopefully you have that. If not, go to my webpage and buy it in the library. But it's one of my historically, it's like transposed for DVD. It's remastered. And so anyway, what I did is I took these textbooks and I went into my classroom. Now I've got, hundreds of students in these classes. And so what I did is I said, we're going to divide you into groups and say, this group here will take Venus, this group here will take Mars, this group here will take galaxies, this group here will take asteroid belt or whatever the topic. And I want you to go through all of the textbooks. This was a project because they had to complete a project to get their grade in my astronomy class. And so they had to go through all of the textbooks and look at the authors and who authored the articles, who authored the books. And it turned out that they discovered that the review board for one textbook were the authors of another textbook and vice versa. So there was this complete corroboration so that all of these textbooks said the same thing. And of course, it's the same baloney that they're teaching now. And of course, this is about 10 years after Carl Sagan releases his Cosmos series, solidifying what standard science had to teach. And so anyway, so I did this textbook study. It's called Astronomy for the 90s. And professionally produced. So I encourage you to go see that, because what I do is compare all of these topics in the textbooks. And what I realized was they taught all kinds of things that had no proof at all. There was no astronomical proof, like the Oort cloud. It's supposedly this cloud of comets which exists far outside of the solar system, but has never been detected, never could be detected, and supposedly that's where ice ball comets come from. And so, anyway, a very interesting result, being able to produce this video. Okay, so another interesting, just like an anecdote about this class that I would teach, and I started this in my first class, which was only 30 students, but I would come into class and I would notice it was one of those days where the students just they just looked like they were not interested. You know, it's like, okay, another book, you know, what are we going to learn today type of thing. And astronomy can be boring for the average person, learning about all these facts about the planets and stars, and it might be interesting, but they're there to get their grade and get their requirement. So I'd come in and I'd say, you know, I'm kind of sensing you people are just not, you're just not with it today. You're just not interested. And so we're going to do something different. And, you know, the heads would perk up like, oh, good. Well, we're going to do something different. I said, close your books, et cetera. And we're going to do something. We're going to go through a little exercise here. And I didn't tell them where this was going. Anyway, well, I'll just explain this. I would say, okay, we're going to take something that go down the street, down the block, near where you live or something like that, and think of something that was not there last week. Did somebody plant a tree? Did somebody break ground for new construction? Did somebody paint their house? You know, just something that was in the last week new. And so they would go through this and think of something. And I go, okay, let's go back a month. Something that wasn't there down the block from the school or whatever. And think of something, and, you know, people would think of things. And I said, okay, now let's go back, you know, 6 months. Think of something that was not here 6 months ago. And so, you know, they got the rhythm of doing this. And then we started talking about bigger installations like suburbs or maybe a big industry or something like that, or towns, you know. Or like you finally get back 200 years and a whole towns were not there. It was prairie or mountainous regions. And then you get back, you know, 300 years before the great population, European population of the Western Plains. And going back now, go back 500 years, you know, 1,000 years and 2,000 years, and you get back into history. Or you get back to the time of, say, Marco Polo, and he connects the East, the spice route that went across basically through the Gobi Desert, to the east and connects it, bringing back spices to the West, etc., the first communication between the Eastern society and the Western society. And then I'd hit them with the punchline. I would say, you know, now you, what you're seeing is these civilizations, or for example, Columbus crosses the ocean and finds the indigenous, the Aborigines in the Caribbean islands, and then on the mainland, and then all of a sudden they discover that the Aztecs living there, millions of people, you know, in what is now Mexico, or the Incas, you know, or the remnants of the Mayan. And then, you know, you find all these population centers around the world, and eventually, say, the Hawaiian Islands in the 1850s were discovered, and a whole population of people who had been there with very advanced culture, actually, for thousands of years, literally. And so what you find is that the world started, as it expanded and as travel became available, the civilization started to encounter other civilizations that were there in the world. And so then you get to the point of, what have you been taught in history about the origin of man? And then you have the Leakeys talking about these little mini humanoid people living in Africa 100 million years ago, but then eventually evolved into the people living between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in the Mideast, and then they expanded out, and then they went across the Alaska Bering Strait and wandered into the United States. And what you realize is that story could not possibly be true. And these students, in understanding this, realized that there was not some kind of steady progression of people moving out from this one birthplace of man. And they started to get angry because in their own just logical way, and I tricked them into doing this. Anyway, I've talked about this before in my other radio shows. I don't want to go into a lot of detail here, but then they would get angry. They would get angry and they'd say, well, everything we've been taught doesn't make any sense here. And I said, okay, now your assignment for tonight is to go out to the library, go to your resources of information, and find out what the real story is. So they'd go marching out of class, off to the library, off to wherever they were going to get their information from. And remember, this is like 1991, before internet really came along. So they had to go get books and encyclopedias and stuff. And they'd come back the next day, and I'd say, okay, now what did you find out? And they'd go, there's nothing out there. There's no information that tells us really where we came from. Everything we've been taught is complete BS. And they were, you know, at this point, they were really mad. They were, because everything that, not only everything they had been taught is wrong, but there's no available information to tell them what's true. And then they would really get angry. And I'd say, okay, you know, this was a lesson, because this is a lesson in astronomy too, because astronomy and what really happened in history has a lot to do with the development of the human race. Because there was a worldwide population thousands and thousands of years ago that was possibly bigger than the population of the Earth today, with transportation, with ocean-going ships, the Earth's poles were different, etc. And that's the real story. And all of that has been obfuscated from you, the students. And I think at this point they're in shock. These students are in shock that they thought, here they are in college, in university level, and have no clue of what the real story of where people came from. Okay, so anyway, the reason I'm talking about this is because this is very important for everybody out there to understand, and it's part of my history of educating people. And people would really appreciate this. When they got done with my course, they felt like they'd been brought out of an eggshell. They had been kept in this eggshell all their life. And of course, like I say, in teaching astronomy, I had to teach from a textbook. These textbooks, which were just ridiculously bogus. And the other thing is, going back to the textbook study, the astronomy for the 90s video, all of the students' notes I have kept over the years. And so I still have that. I still have all the textbooks from 1991, those 15 textbooks for astronomy. And what they found is that the story was consistent through all of those books. And that's because it was kept consistent because, like I said, the authors of one would be the editors of another one. And so by the time they got done, there was a consistent story on Venus, on Mars, and Jupiter. Everything else, everybody said the same thing. Maybe some added a little more information. Some had a little different variation on this or that, some minor point maybe. But in general, they all said the same thing. Okay, so this is back in 1991. And I mean, today, as I give this topic, we're in 2022, and nothing has changed. All of these same bogus theories are still in vogue, and they're going to go on forever because this has been solidified. The scientific community, which is the tier two scientific community, nobody's going to upset the apple cart, whether you're a university professor, a researcher, somebody who is associated with a company like, say, Gulf South Research, which does independent, so-called independent research, etc. Nobody's going to rock the boat. But this is all tier two science. The tier one scientists know that all of this is bogus, but they can't talk. They've already signed away their lifetime, their work. They cannot talk. They cannot go up to a microphone. They're under complete gag orders. Okay, and so I'm moving now into the 1995 to 1998 time frame. I pretty much picked apart this time frame from 91 to 95. But what happens in 1995, July 15th, 1995, is the discovery of Comet Hale-Bopp. And this is where the gloves come off. There is such an explosion of recognition, in a sense, especially at the Tier 1 level, for my work. And what happens? It's a sequence of events that just happened overnight. Now imagine this: the security agencies, the CIA, and the higher levels. Remember, the CIA is the police force of the World Bank, which is the front agency, the Rothschild banking empire, which covers the whole world, basically, is the front agency for the Vatican Bank, which is the Jesuit-operated Vatican in the banking system, etc. And so the CIA and the Vatican knows all about this. They're already using the Hubble Space Telescope. And I'm going to mention also a guy named Malachi Martin, who is on regularly on Art Bell's show, talking about this. And he was the one that disclosed to us that he was in the Vatican, down in the areas where they have a lot of the secret stuff. And he was walking by a computer, and somebody had left a computer terminal on. So he sat down. It was a direct link to the Hubble Space Telescope with observations of the comet Hale-Bopp. And so why is this important? It just shows you the collusion, if you want to call it that, between the Vatican and NASA, which by now, as I've told you, is a CIA-operated agency. It's completely under the umbrella of the CIA. But what happens, they have been watching this object come in with kind of a mini solar system, at least one big moon associated with it. And this thing is bigger than Earth, and it's on a near direct collision course with Earth. And they know this. All of a sudden, July 15th, 2015, doesn't explode, that's the wrong term, but it just ignites. It discharges the solar capacitor and ignites into this giant comet, as does the companion. So you have the companion orbiting the main nucleus, and they're swirling around, and the companion is big. It's enough to make the main nucleus wobble back and forth as it surrounds it. And so the word goes out that there's this big comet with a companion, and there's just like an international flurry of events. I've already mentioned that I called up Goddard, and the secretary knows my voice. I guess I have a particular voice that people recognize. So she goes, "Hello," and I say, "Hello." I don't remember her name. She goes, "James," and then I hear all of this screaming in the background. Pandemonium. People running around, doors slamming. What's going on? And she goes, "Hale-Bopp, it's huge. Hale-Bopp is huge." And at first I thought she was talking about the story of this comet being huge. And it turns out that at this point, the astronomers, the Tier 2 astronomers at Goddard, found out about Hale-Bopp, did some measurements, and came up, of course, with the resolution of the size of the nucleus of Hale-Bopp. And so anyway, Chuck Schrammick, who is a friend of mine, is a talk show host from Houston, and an adversary of NASA. And of course, in Houston, Houston is, remember, one of the big epicenters of NASA. It's when the Apollo astronauts were up there, it was like, hello, Houston. Yes, you know, and Houston, we have a problem. You know, whatever it was, Houston is a big mega center, administrative center for NASA. You know, Chuck Schrammick is a talk show host and very critical of NASA in its hometown of Houston. And I should post maybe even here a little segment from the interview, one of my interviews with Chuck. But anyway, Chuck is also an amateur astronomer. He goes out into his yard, he takes out of his equipment, which is more than amateur equipment. And at the time, 1995, he had auto tracking, he had very good equipment. So he takes a picture of Hale-Bopp, takes a series of pictures, and he sees the companion swinging around the nucleus of Hale-Bopp, and he takes a snapshot of that and he sends it to Art Bell. And so anyway, then Courtney Brown, who is the Far Side, what was it? Courtney Brown, the Far Side Institute, gets a photo from Ali Hainau and Hal Weaver from the University of Hawaii, they're the head of the astronomy department there. And of course, they have the big installation on Mauna Kea, I believe? Yeah, in Hawaii, the big volcanic mountain, which is extinct. And they have a big astronomical observatory facility up there, not just one telescope. But they zone in, they take and they send to Courtney Brown an image with the companion, and Courtney Brown sends an image, a photograph, to Art Bell at the same time. Art Bell posts these on his webpage innocently. You know, just, this is information for the public. It's come to him through two independent sources. And then NASA, Hal Weaver and Ali Hainau from the University of Hawaii, go back and Photoshop the image of Hale-Bopp that they had and remove the companion and say that Courtney Brown and Chuck Schrammick were the ones who doctored the photographs. So anyway, this gets Art Bell in a lot of trouble. And then there's an independent thing that occurs. And let me go into a little bit of detail here. And by the way, during this time frame, I talk about this in my book, Planet X Update 2020, The Real History of Planet X. So go there for this complete story, which that book was published in just a couple of years ago, relaying this whole history of Hale-Bopp. So I'm just going to give a little piece of this. So at any rate, there's a group called Heaven's Gate, which is, they're programmers, and they're programming firewalls and encryption software that the CIA cannot break into, and the intelligence agencies, and by the way, the NSA, the National Security Agency, is very much under surveilling everything going on. And they're very much against any company selling encryption software that they can't break into. So they've already warned the Heaven's Gate people, and that's where the term Heaven's Gate comes from. It's like a gate. It's like an encryption gate that you're not able to pass. And they were selling this on the market to businesses as encryption software, and the CIA and the NSA did not want this. And so they already had a couple strikes against them, but also they were waiting for a sign, and they had probably a following of the estimated 30,000 people across the United States. And they sent out the word to all of these people to converge on Los Angeles, and they were going to go out into the Hollywood Hills and wait, because Hale-Bopp, they were waiting for this signal. I mean, this is just factual information. And they were so these 30,000 people are converging on LA airports and coming in by car or however, and they're going to meet and they're going to go out on this hillside and wait for the aliens to come in. And what's more significant here is that there was signaling from the region around Hale Bopp relative to, you know, basically was alien signaling. It was not the type of signaling you would expect from a comet. It was intelligence signaling. And I know this from the information I got out of intelligence agencies. And so all of this is going on, and the CIA is freaking out. They've been tracking this object all this time. Never in a million years did they expect it to become a comet. And of course, all of these people know specifically about my work, and it's one that's, again, just solid proof that comets are not dirty snowballs, that this object turns into this absolutely explosive, not explosive, but ignited comet with a companion. And you can see that in the original videos that are posted, NASA posted them. Somebody from NASA inadvertently posted this video, which they took down right away, but many people captured it. A little video showing the nucleus of Hale Bopp spinning around and the companion spinning around, and there's two comets, two independent comets. And so anyway, a person who I later met, and now as I go through this story, I'm going to tell you something. I'm not going to release the names of people who are still living. I may talk about a couple of people who have passed on and are not with us anymore, and there's a very good reason for that. But anyway, this person ended up capturing that video online. NASA took it down, and also there was information that was put up on a webpage hosted by Brian Marsden at the Smithsonian, and it was the basically the ephemeris for all of these different solar system objects, including comets. There's the place where they kept the database for orbits for all objects, asteroids, planets, comets, extra solar system objects, etc., mainly associated with the solar system. But that's where they kept the database. So they started keeping a database on Hale Bopp as a comet, once it ignited into a comet. And that's Brian Marsden. And his name, by the way, he's passed on now. He was keeping the database and publishing it. And when this first came out, he said that Hale Bopp was so big that there would be no deviation in its orbit, because they believed that jetting from an ice ball comet is what caused comet wandering, one of the unexplained issues with comets, that comets did not follow Keplerian orbits. There was some kind of other force going on that caused them to wander continually out of their normal orbital paths. And so anyway, that's why the ancients, by the way, called comets the lawless ones, because they did not obey standard orbital dynamics. So the ancients understood orbital dynamics, elliptical orbits, etc. But anyway, back to Chuck Schrammick. I was on Chuck's radio show and as an invited guest, talking about the plasma discharge comet model and how NASA was basically lying, covering up data, etc., dishonest about the whole issue of comets and what they were, etc. And then Hale Bopp hits, this whole Hale Bopp issue. What happened to these people afterwards? Chuck Schrammick eventually and shortly thereafter died of rapid onset cancer, the same thing that killed Robert Harrington, oddly enough. And there were other people who ended up dying in this whole thing. And this is where all of the Planet X baloney hit the street, because remember, the CIA knew about this from 1991 to 1995. They knew that eventually amateur astronomers would see this thing coming in, and they probably didn't realize that it wouldn't happen until this thing, they didn't know that it was going to ignite into a comet. But eventually somebody would notice it, be able to track in orbit. And so the CIA had a plan, a disinformation plan, and it was centered around some people who worked for the CIA, who were programmers also, who lived out in Los Angeles, and built a program system called Promise Software. And it just happened to be the same people who were in charge of the Skywatch program, which was a worldwide program for gathering information on UFOs, unidentified flying objects, and human contact of the first, second, third kind with humans, with aliens. So the CIA was very interested in this, and the Skywatch organization had offices all over the planet, and of course no visible source of income to support all of these offices. It was commensurate also with something called MUFON, which was more of a private organization, but also highly infiltrated by the CIA. Okay, so as you can see, my comet work comes at the very center of all of this. So I don't remember how the initial contact came about, but the person who captured that, just a very short video of Hale Bopp off the internet, started publishing it and asking questions, and we connected at the time. And this, of course, was in the early days of the internet. So they developed a internet page called the Millennium Group, just like it sounds, the Millennium Group. And I started posting on there as the main contributor. And at the same time, of course, my fame was growing and dealing with this whole issue of Hale Bopp. And by the way, the Heaven's Gate people, if you don't remember, all of a sudden there were 37 people or some number like that, 27, 37 people who died in the so-called mass suicide. It was actually the CIA poisoning these people. It was a mass murder because they had to shut down the lid on this immense group of people coming into Los Angeles waiting for aliens to come pick them up, when in fact the CIA was getting alien signals from Hale Bopp. And so anyway, this is the real story of what happened. And all of a sudden, I'm on the Art Bell Show. This is when I was very first on the Art Bell Show, dealing with the issue of Hale Bopp. And there were some very good investigators with this group called the Millennium Group. And what they discovered is that the images that Hal Weaver and Ali Hainau of the University of Hawaii provided to the newspapers, claiming that Art Bell was wrong and then accusing Art Bell of being responsible for the death of 37 people in a mass suicide by publishing incorrect information on the internet. And basically, they ruined Art Bell. It took them a number of years before they finally got rid of Art Bell. But I remember being on the air with Whitley Strieber and Art Bell, and I'm the guest, and telling Art Bell, he was very angry, and I brought up the issue of the companion of Hale Bopp, and Art was very angry with me on the air, stating that they had been through that, that had been conclusively proven that Chuck Schrammick and Courtney Brown's photos were the ones that were doctored. And I told him on the air, no, you're incorrect, and here's the proof that Ali Hainau and Hal Weaver, University of Hawaii, were the ones that fabricated the content for the newspapers to blame Art Bell and then blame him for the death of 37 people. And later, just to cap this off, there was a 1997, it was, let me see, I have the date here. Where is my notes? I'm sorry. March, there was the conference was announced in March of 1997, and it actually occurred February 2nd to 5th, 1998. So this is a couple years into the discovery of Hale Bopp. Hale Bopp was discovered in 1995, July 15th. So 2 years later, less than 2 years later, the European Space Agency calls an international conference on Hale Bopp, because this is an amazing comet. Nobody's ever seen anything like this before. It has an orbit that puts it 6 years in the solar system with visible eye contact. In other words, you can see Comet Hale-Bopp for a period of 6 years up in the sky. It's just there it is. It was so bright you could actually see it in the daytime sky. I remember seeing Hale-Bopp myself up in the sky in the broad daylight. And NASA is trying to convince everybody that this is just a little snowball. Don't worry about it. It's a little bit bigger than most snowballs, but that's all it is. And literally, this is Planet X in the solar system in the form of a comet. And so the CIA had this story planned with one of the people who was co-owner of the company that was building the Promise software. And they built a story around a woman who allegedly talked to aliens and was predicted that on May 15th, 2023, that the whole world would end because of Planet X, and it would come as this big orange ball over the horizon, when they knew, in fact, that that date was the date of a big orange full moon, which we just had one here a couple of weeks ago. But at the time, this full moon would come up over the horizon, and everybody would think that it was Planet X. And that was the plan. Anyway, I will talk more about that later. But I'm on Art Bell's show telling him that, in fact, he had been had, and that in fact, he had posted pictures that were correct, that had a companion. But the point that I'm talking and going ahead a little bit here about the Canary Island Conference hosted by the European Space Agency, it was the actual conference pulled off in 1998, February 1998. But the very first topic on the agenda was Hal Weaver talking about the companion of Planet X. So they knew it was there in the scientific conference related to Hale-Bopp. They talked about it, but they still continued to lie to the news media for the public, stating there was no companion. Complete lie to cover up and to make the public think that this group of people committed suicide. And by the way, the poison that they gave them was the same poison that they gave to the James Jones group, there was a mass suicide previously. They were very concerned that these people were going to, I forget, one of the South American countries, and they were setting up a communal type of thing, and there were thousands of people moving there out of the United States. And of course, they didn't belong to the banking system, everything else. And these, you can see how afraid they are of groups becoming independent or doing things that, in the case of the Heaven's Gate people, contacting aliens, because they also know that groups of people that get together have extremely large amount of psychic power when combined. Okay, so at any rate, this is a little bit of a diversion. The reason I'm explaining all of this history is because this is not the history you're going to read on Wikipedia, which is a total fabricated lie from beginning to end. And this is not the information you're going to read in the newspaper, in the New York Times, or on the evening news, etc., or any of the standard history of these events. I know about them because I lived through them. And like I tell people, when I bring you information, it's because I was there. It's something I saw for myself. It's something, the information I have, I didn't read it on somebody's web page. I didn't read it in a book, whatever. It's because I was there, and I'm bringing you the information because I saw it. And what's important about this is because this is a history of my discoveries and activities, etc. But once again, my work is cast right in the middle of this basically international, very convoluted affair, and the denial, what they have to do is deny my work because it explains Hale-Bopp. Now, let me go back to Brian Marsden and the Millennium Group page. The Millennium Group page was capturing daily the ephemeris for Hale-Bopp. And it was changing on a daily basis. So Brian Marsden's statement at the very beginning that this was a large comet and it would not experience frequent changes in its orbital characteristics was negated by the very ephemeris information that he was posting on his webpage every day, which was changing drastically every day. Eventually, they got to the point to say, well, it was Jupiter that caused the change in Hale-Bopp's orbit. Hale-Bopp came in on a 4,200-year orbit, 4,250 years. And by the way, that was Harrington calculations based on his original discovery of planet X. It left the solar system with a 2,600-year orbit, so it lost almost 40% of its orbital period in one orbit around the sun. That's the tail drag. That's the tail drag, which is causing the comet to spiral in closer to the sun and slowing it down in its orbit. So those are the two things that take place because of the tail drag from my plasma discharge comet model. Okay, so once again, like I say, my work is at the very center of this. But now what happens is the Russians come in. The Russian scientists from the University of Novosibirsk. Novosibirsk is a central university in central Russia, which is heavily based in science. There's a group of atmospheric scientists there that come in and they look at my work, what they can see of my work, and they go, this is explaining what we see in our atmospheric science. They had already seen the tornadoes on the sun, big tornadoes racing across the surface of the sun, and they don't know what's causing them. They had all kinds of atmospheric activity in Earth's atmosphere that they could not explain. And there was like also the Tunguska event. There's this big explosion in the middle of Siberia, and I believe in 1905, that levels 100 miles in all directions the forest, just blown down and burnt to a crisp, and blowing out windows 100 miles away. And they didn't know what caused this because there's no impact crater. At first you would think, okay, a meteor came in, hit the ground and exploded and caused this tremendous wind. No, there was nothing there. And so anyway, they looked at my work and they said, can you explain the Tunguska event? I said, yeah, that's a discharge from a comet. And the people in that area had seen a number of nights before the sky very bright, and then a number of nights afterwards. And it was not just one explosion, it was a number. But the big one was the one that hit at the Tunguska event, and it was a discharge between a passing comet and Earth. And so they were fascinated with my work. So anyway, this began a very long collaboration between myself and the Russian scientists at the University of Novosibirsk. And you can see some of the communications. Some of them were by email, some of them by other indication. And I'm not going to go into other details about that research that was a collaboration between myself and these Russian scientists. That's just private information, is not for public consumption. But every day after their classes, there would be a session. And they would get their scientists together. They would take a piece of my work, mainly the three-part comet paper. And this is before my public books were available. This is like 1995. And we would translate them. And there's a person who I want to give credit here. He's passed on, and he's not with us anymore, so I'm going to put his name in here, is Earl Crockett. And Earl was a man of very highest standards. He was a businessman from California. And he's the one who implemented the initial translations, etc., and got the translators working, which initiated my entire collaboration with them. And I'm going to read off a list here of the various things that were accomplished in that time. But I'm going to jump forward here a number of decades. I'm going to go up to a American Geophysical Union meeting that occurred in April of 2008. Now, as you know, I regularly attended throughout my career American Geophysical Union meeting, and primarily in the region of solar magnetosphere physics and other topics, and of course, dealing with comets and plasma, etc. I had many different areas that I worked in presenting at the American Geophysical Union meetings, but this particular one, I was dealing with aspects of solar physics, so there were a lot of solar physics physicists at the meeting. But with any American Geophysical Union meeting, there are activities that happen in the evening, like a visit to a local manufacturer or some kind of supper event, kind of a social event where you can go out and mix with all the various scientists. Anyway, and this was in Fort Lauderdale, and what they had was a boat ride. So they had solicited this very large kind of like mini cruise ship, and it went up and down the Intercoastal Canal. And it held maybe a couple hundred people. Remember, the American Geophysical Union meetings would have between 10 and 20,000 scientists there. And so anyway, I signed up for this. I thought, well, that'll be fun, you know, an evening cruise. And they give you a nice supper and everything. It's, you know, and they go up the Intercoastal Canal and sunset and everything in the evening. So I go on this cruise and I'm going around and I see all the scientists that I typically see, the solar physicists, etc. there. And I go around, I talk to various people. And I go up on the top front deck out in the bow, and I'm out there leaning against the rail, and I'm there by myself. And so out of the door leading out to this front deck that I'm on comes this young lady. And she gets up on holds the rail, and she's standing next to me, and she's talking to me. And she has a very thick Russian accent. She just had gotten her PhD in solar physics, and she's there at the meeting, beautiful blonde hair, maybe 25 years old. And so I'm talking to her about solar physics and the magnetos, you know, the what's known, what's not known, and things like that. And so after talking to her a little bit, I turn and I say, well, my name is James McCanny. And she goes, I know. I studied your work as a little girl. So my jaw, like, hit the deck, basically. And it was like, but this was an indication of, I mean, that's, to me, was telling me something. So this was, like I say, 2008, probably a good 12 years after I had worked with these. And so my work was being taught in Russian universities as the standard science of the day. And these people, this young girl had been in some either grade school or high school. She didn't say what age it was that she learned about my work, but she said, I learned this as a young girl. I studied your work as a young girl. That was her exact comment. Other thing, just a quick comment. In the conversation, we were talking about, I don't know how we got on this subject, but she said, I don't have time for television. I don't own a television. I never have. It would interfere with my work. So these people in foreign countries are very serious. For example, when you see Russian skaters or Russian pianists or Russian violinists, or in this case, a Russian physicist, they are dedicated to that. And I find that interesting because that's the way I was. When I was going to college, etc., or university, or doing my work, I was very dedicated to it. Okay, so the reason I started talking about this was because out of the Millennium group of people, and through the efforts of Earl Crockett, who was basically reunite me with the Russian scientists, that's where it started, and it began this very long and extensive collaboration between me and the professors at the University of Novosibirsk, who, like I said, they were physicists, Alexei Dmitriev, Alexander Tetanov, others there, And eventually the psychology department, this is a real interesting story, because every day the physics department would have these meetings and translate more of my work and ask questions and go back and forth, taking it a piece at a time. And the word got out to the psychology department at the University of Novosibirsk, and they had been doing studies on babies prenatal and postnatal, and they were trying to understand the connection between just the physical inputs, because they knew that the babies were reacting to cycles that they had discovered were related to the planetary positions. But they had no explanation. And of course, this is almost related, or it is related to astrology. In other words, how do the positions of the planets relate to, because there is no gravitational relationship, because the gravitational forces are very, very weak. And besides, we're gravitationless relative to all other celestial bodies. That's just the way gravity works. There are gravitational forces, but because we're in this free-flowing space-time medium, like, for example, astronauts are in a gravitationless mode when they're in orbit around Earth. They're subjected to forces, but those forces are offsetting, which gives them a gravitationless environment. And so they're trying to figure out what is causing this, and especially the point of birth. What's going on there? And so they gained an interest in sitting in with these Russian physicists and atmospheric scientists relative to my work. And what we realized was that the babies were receiving electrical signaling from the planets. Every planet has its characteristic electromagnetic signaling. Jupiter, Mars, Earth, Mercury, etc. And for example, you've heard the term Mercury going retrograde. Why would little Mercury spinning around the sun, near the sun, influence us people here on Earth in a bizarre way where everything becomes confused and muddled and contracts become goofy, etc.? And so anyway, the answer is that they're electromagnetic signaling, and we respond to those. We're antennas. We're receiving antennas, and we're transmitting antennas. And so anyway, what they realized that the baby in the womb, because they had sensors, they would actually have sensors that could read the baby signaling while it was in the mother's stomach. And they realized that there was patterns going on relative to the planets. And when the baby was born, all of a sudden, all of their senses would kick in. Sight, sound, you know, smell, all of the senses would kick in. And that would dominate the input into the brain, where the brain now is sorting out all of this huge amount of information coming in. And so that the baby's signaling relative to the planets was very instrumental at that time of birth. And that's why astrology, which is an empirical science, now had a fundamental scientific basis, because the baby is reacting to the planetary signaling, the electromagnetic signaling that's coming into Earth's atmosphere from the planets, from the moon, from in all of these different cycles. And this is why, for example, you find that ocean life is very tuned to the lunar cycle because of electrical signaling. It's women, for example, when they live communally, will all start to have their monthly period cycle coincide. And I've heard this from women, like in college, the girls used to talk about it, that, you know, there are a lot of women living in a dormitory. They would all have their monthly cycle, you know, synchronized after a short period of time. And that's because of this electrical signaling going on. Another aspect of this is when, say, two people meet, you know, you see this in the movies, the people are going about whatever they're doing, and all of a sudden they're face to face and they look at each other and they, you know, it's love at first sight. It's that physical, spiritual connection. It's like magnets that are attracting when they get close together. And it's just like, it's one of those amazing things of the human being, is that ability to connect spiritually with other people. And so anyway, the point of talking about all of this is this group of psychologists at the University of Novosibirsk made a major discovery psychologically as this understanding that people are reacting to the positions of the planets. And then when you have planetary alignments, like say we align with Jupiter, I always talk about the Jupiter winds. Well, there's more going on than that, than just the wind. The wind blowing hard, you're making an electrical connection, etc. And we get this huge influx of electrons. This is electrical, and the human body is picking up on this. Okay, so back to, I'm going to just try and read you a few of the items that were discovered here with the work with the Russians. The X-ray experiment, where my work predicted that the fusion of the sun is up in the atmosphere. And this was proven from Jupiter, from Saturn, from the Voyager spacecraft. I've gone through all of this. And they did a very interesting experiment using X-rays. And I described that in one of my books. I think it's in the weather book, the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather. I talk about this experiment that the Russians did to prove that the solar fusion is up in the atmosphere and not in the core. I talked about the Tunguska event, understanding that that was a electrical discharge from a passing comet. The tornadoes on the sun, they finally understood that these are electrical phenomenon and that the tornadoes and hurricanes on the earth, etc., are caused by electrical discharges in the vertical electric field, which led also to the work on the understanding that hurricanes are powered from the vertical electric field. And tornadoes and cyclones and water spouts all are powered from this same vertical electric field. And the dust storms on Mars, for example. They also were instrumental in 1994, July 1994. Schumacher Levy 9 showed these 21 pieces. In fact, that's the cover picture of my book on comets. But they turned into sulfur dioxide comets as they approached Jupiter. And of course, the dirty snowball comet model cannot explain why all of a sudden ice ball water comets turn into sulfur dioxide comets. Okay, I have a very long list here, so obviously I'm not going to get through it in this show. We'll pick up on this next week. Remember, these broadcasts are brought to you commercial-free by my own websites, jmccsci.com, and the water filter webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com, or just type in mymr5.com, and it'll take you to the sales page for the whole house water filter. I also have the best replacement filter elements for gravity filters on that page. Once again, the water filter page, jmccwaterfilters.com. The latest technology, and also my main original webpage, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.